You're listening to Popstar Conversations, taking you inside with your favorite musical artists.
Today, Chuck and I are sitting here with a multi-talented singer, songwriter, producer, guitarist, and actor, Ed Sheeran. Ed, welcome to the show.
Ed, good to see you.
Do you enjoy doing interviews?
No, do you know what? It goes up and down. I was in, where was I? Holland in Den Haag, and I did three interviews there, and they were the best interviews I ever done. Like, just fucking really cool. And they were just all about kind of like they weren't about my music or me. They were just about what I thought about the music industry, which I kind of love talking about. So yeah, it was good. But then I had some radio interviews this morning that were, you know, in interviews when they just state facts and you just agree and you go, yeah, that did happen. It's that kind of vibe.
However, Plus is not your first album. It's your third, isn't it?
I'd like to call it my first album because it's my first kind of imprint on mainstream society. Well, the previous two were done 2006, 2007. So this one's a lot more mature and it's a lot more rounded and I kind of know what my sound is and I'd like to think it's better.
Ed, would you consider this more of a folk hip-hop record or what category would you put this in?
Yeah, I mean the thing I didn't want to get boxed into was confusing the audience too much because I have a lot of influences and a lot of loves in music, and if you put all of them onto one album, sometimes it confuses people. So I took the opportunity with five different EPs to make five different sounds that I was really into, and through the course of that, I kind of realized what my sound would be by making other people's sounds. So this is my sound.
Is it more important for you to be known as a rapper or for your guitar playing?
I don't want to be the best anything. I want to be the best me I can be. I know that sounds really twee and shit, but like there are rappers out there that are always going to be better than me, and there are the guitarists out there that are always going to be better than me, but there's no one that can make my music better than me, so I'm just going to continue doing my music.
Was it Damien Rice who inspired you to be a musician?
Yeah, Damien Rice was the moment where I realized you didn't have to be in a band to make it. You can, or even make an impact, because I saw him play and one guy on stage had more presence than any rock band, and it was really cool.
What inspired you to write about a heroin addicted prostitute in the A-Team, and were you really surprised that it became such a hit?
It's weird with the A-Team because radio never wants to play it and TV never wants to play it, and then it just blew up and then everyone had to play it, and it was a bit strange like to have a song get successful in that way and to be playing gig. Like, most of my gigs, the average age is between about 18 and 40, but sometimes I get booked for younger shows. Like, I got booked for this show called Girl Guides gig, and it was at Wembley Arena, and it was around 12,000 8-year-old girls, because it was just their kind of like Girl Scouts thing. So when I played that song and you have 12,000 8-year-old girls singing Go Mad for a Couple of Grams, I was kind of like, wow, this has definitely crossed over. Yeah, I think, you know, because the song's done tastefully and it's not obvious that it's about a drug addict unless you actually properly listen into it, I think people are okay with it.
In the song, You Need Me, I Don't Need You, in those lyrics, are you referring to someone or something specifically?
It's kind of about the industry, and it's not really about me either. I know it's kind of a very kind of personal song with lyrics about my life and stuff, but it's kind of more of a, I wanted to create a kind of anthem for independent musicians out there to be able to say, look, like, at some point you do need a label because you do need the international, the marketing, the press, the TV, the whatever, but you don't need an A&R if you know what you want to do. Like some acts, like pop acts, definitely need their A&Rs. They need people to write with, they need kind of producers and stuff. But if you do your thing and you know it's good, if someone comes up to you and tells you to change it, then that's what you need to say. You need me, I don't need you, because the industry would not run if it wasn't for acts that made their own music and did it well. Because you can have pop bands all day long, but when someone like Adele comes up, that refunds the industry. And her selling 30 million records makes everyone kind of get excited again and start signing good acts and pushing good music out there and stuff. And yeah, it's just a song like that. It's just to say, like, keep doing your own thing and it will eventually break through.
and you don't have to graduate from a Brit school to become a success.
No, no, that line wasn't so much a dig at the Brit school. It was more of a dig of people thinking that I went to Brit school. There was a time when I wrote that tune where people like Adele and Leona Lewis and The Kooks and who else? Imogen Heap went there. Like, all these people went to Brit school. And there was a Brits once where they all won Brits. And in the press, it was like young people, young musicians, Brit school, blah, blah, blah. And every time I do a gig, there'd be someone afterwards that'd be going, oh, you went to Brit school, didn't you? And I'd be like, no. So I put it in the song just to kind of make clear that people knew that I didn't. But it was never a dig at the Brit school.
Is it true that your label wanted to change your appearance?
I think it's better to look like in a management's eyes and a record company's eyes, the more marketable you are features-wise, the easier it is to market you. When actually, nowadays, people like people that look like themselves. Like, Adele does not look like Beyonce, but she can sing like Beyonce, and that's why people, you know, she's just a normal person. She doesn't look too unobtainable, if that makes sense. And I think they wanted me to kind of be a bit more boy band, a bit more model-esque, but I think the fact that I'm not, and even though the album sold however many copies it sold and we're selling out gigs and stuff, I can still wear the same hoodie every day and the same jeans every day and kind of look like the kid next door that doesn't really wash. But I do wash.
Ed, did you really record this record plus in your garden shed?
Yeah.
It seems you created this sort of a lo-fi feel, except for the last song, which is really different.
Yeah, that was done in the shed as well. Like, yeah. So, you know what? The second to last one was the only one that wasn't. The vocals were done there, but that was kind of done more polished up in LA with a guy called No ID. But we did the vocals in the shed. But I'd done all my recordings in this shed in Surrey, and it just didn't make sense to kind of go somewhere else. And, you know, because A-Team was already a hit by the time we started making the album, and that was done in the shed like a year ago. So if that's good enough to get on radio the way it is, then why not record the whole album like it?
Ed, I heard that you wrote the song Wake Me Up at Jamie Foxx's house in L.A.
It was written there. It's more about kind of like, I wanted to write a love song. That love songs nowadays, it's quite hard to write an original love song because it's usually kind of like, you know, baby, this is the way I feel, or, you know, my heart bleeds without you, and but all of that. And I kind of wanted to write a song that was a bit more blunt and a bit more kind of like, the reason I'm in love with you is because we watch Shrek and we do this and fucking, I don't know, play Xbox and I never win, like that, just to be kind of more straight to the point, rather than, because I've got a whole album of love songs that are a bit more subtle, so I just wanted to write a blunt one that was a bit straight to the point.
I understand that Elton John has been very instrumental in your career as a mentor and a fan. How often do you keep in touch?
Once every 2 weeks, maybe. Good. He's a lovely guy. Really, really nice guy. What makes him a fan? I think he's just excited about new music in general. Like, he loves new bands and new CDs, and he gets very excited when he likes an album, and thankfully he likes my records, so he's kind of into it. And on my management we have like James Blunt and Lily Allen as well, and he got very excited about them and they did all right.
So we're talking about what, a 3-year overnight success here?
4-year.
And if you were to do it all over, would you do anything differently?
Nah, because everything that I've done has shaped who I am today, and the music I play today, and the live act that you see today. That everything that's happened has done that. I wouldn't do anything differently.
Ed, let me ask you, has success changed your life?
The only thing, nothing's changed apart from my time. So I've got the same friends, same family, live on the same sofa, eat the same food, wear the same clothes, play bigger gigs. That's changed, I guess. Playing bigger gigs, sell more records, that's changed. I can't really go out in public, that's changed. And I haven't got a lot of time.
Were you surprised by reaching number one on the charts so soon?
I'd like to say yes, but I wasn't too bothered about where it charted, because in England you can sell 30,000 and go to number one, or you can sell 200,000 and go to number one. And, you know, selling 30,000 isn't like a amazing week to have. And if I'd have gone number one and sold 30,000, you know, it would have been good because I'd have gone number one, but it wouldn't have been like, you know, I wouldn't have been over the moon about it, because the label kind of put pressure on me to sell a certain amount week one, which was around 60,000. So when we sold 100,000, that's when I was happy and that's when I was surprised. It wasn't about the chart position, because you can sell different amounts and get to number one. So chart positions don't really mean anything. It's all about kind of sales. So doing 100,000 week one was a very, very nice thing to happen. I was happy.
How much time, if any, do you spend on social media?
I probably spend an unhealthy amount of time on social networks, but only because I get bored on trains. And I think things like Twitter are important because nowadays with albums and music, you can get it for free anywhere. Like, I could go out now onto that computer and find 16 different download sites you could find this album on for free. So there's no pressure to not download it for free, for instance, because you're losing £8 buying an album where you could get it for free. So nowadays, the only reason someone's going to buy your album really is if there's a connection with you, if they feel like they know you, if they think you're a nice person and you deserve it. The amount of people that would say, oh, I bought your album because I saw this interview and you seemed all right, or people who'd be like, I think you're a prick and that's why I downloaded it for free. Like, there's those things. So social networking, things like Twitter, if your personality comes across on Twitter, however much you tweet. So if people feel like they know you and that you're a good person and you deserve their £8, which is a weird way to look at music nowadays, but you know, that's when they'll buy your record. So I think it's more important to use social media nowadays. And I think the reason why I've had so much success is I have quite a loyal, loving fan base who every time I release something, they're like, fuck it, let's get it to number one. That's what we, Ed deserves this. We saw Ed when he was playing to four people and Ed needs to go to number one with this. And that's why they'll support it. Whereas I know acts in England that have been going for years that were getting number ones 10 years ago or whatever because their record was getting hammered on radio, and then they got Twitter and everyone's kind of like, yeah, they're a bit of a cunt, and don't buy their shit anymore.
Ed, I'm curious, why did you cast Rupert Grint for the Lego House video? Are you a big Harry Potter fan?
I am actually, yeah, but it was more like I wanted to make a video where someone else played me that looked enough like me for people to believe that was me, if that makes sense. Which is great because people all around the world now think that Rupert Grint's started off a music career and they're like, oh, have you heard Rupert Grint's new song? And people are like, no, it's actually Ed, which is kind of my intention, so it's good.
And one last question before we go. Who inspired you to pick up the guitar?
It was Eric Clapton. I saw him at the Queen's Jubilee on TV playing Layla. And I was like, that's a pretty cool riff. I want to learn that riff. And then I learned the riff. And then I was like, actually, it's quite a cool song. I want to learn the whole song. So I learned the whole song. And then I was into Green Day at the time. So I learned all the Green Day songs on guitar, which weren't too complicated. And then I got into Hendrix and played all the Hendrix songs. And then I got into Rory Gallagher and did all the Rory Gallagher songs. And I just got very passionate about the guitar by watching other guitarists kind of do their thing. But Damien Rice was the point where I bought an acoustic guitar and started doing the strummy thing.
Ed, thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for listening to Popstar Conversations. Be sure to click the subscribe button below and hit the red bell so that you'll be notified of our next exclusive interview. Thank you again for listening.
Thank you for listening to Popstar Conversations. Please join us again for another conversation with your favorite musical artist.